Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matthew Miller, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Reuven Mull about his new book, Faith Fulfilled, Megillat Esther and the Ma'ariv Evening Service for Purim, with commentary from the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, published by Ketav in 2022. Faith Fulfilled presents selections of the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, one of the major Jewish philosophers of the 20th century, as a new and meaningful commentary for the Megillah and Ma'ariv service. Reuven, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Matthew. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Reuven Mull. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Went to Yeshiva Manhattan Beach for elementary school and Yeshiva Flatbush for high school. After high school, I went to for a year of study in Israel to Yeshiva HaKotel, and then got an undergraduate degree at Yeshiva University. After that, I went on to dental school at NYU, New York University Dental School. And through that and afterwards, I did study. Even though when I was at Yeshiva University, I did study for a little bit. That's in the Smicha program, and I continue in my studies. And I did receive Smicha afterwards from Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg in Jerusalem. That's a little bit about myself. I do live in Teaneck, New Jersey, with my wife Jenny, and we have three children at this point. So thank God everything is good.
Beautiful. That's great. And going to the book itself, how did you come to write this book? And this is not the first time you've written about and looked at the teachings of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. How did you come to write about this individual, think about his teachings, appreciate his teachings, and then more specifically, this book?
Sure. So first, I'll just tell a little bit about who Eliezer Berkowitz was. Eliezer Berkowitz was one, as you said, one of the major Jewish philosophers of the 20th century. He was born in 1908 and he passed away in 1992. I first came or introduced to him, actually. My father is a retired professor of philosophy. So a lot of talk of philosophy in the house growing up. I came to and I was introduced to him with the first book that I was introduced to him was the book Faith After the Holocaust. But I'll just tell a little bit about his life first. So basically, he was born in 1908. He went through the Holocaust. He was a rabbi in Berlin from 1934 to 1939. And he has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Berlin. On the dissertation was on Hume and miracles. So he's just a great figure for somebody in the modern Orthodox world that has this vast knowledge of secular studies and also Torah studies. One who wants to look into Torah Mada and know that the intersection of all of these works in his writings, where he talks about all the philosophy and everything is in there between the philosophy, the Torah, and everything is in his writings. After he was a rabbi in Berlin from 1934 to 1939, he escaped, went to England, was a rabbi in England for a few years, then a rabbi in Australia for a few years, and then he finally came to Boston from 1950 to 1958. And then in 1958 to 1976, he went to Chicago, where that was his major role. He was the head of the philosophy department at Hebrew Theological College in Skokie. And then in 1976, he made Aliyah, and he remained the remainder of his life's teaching in Israel. After that, he wrote amazingly 19 books during his lifetime. I can go through some of the books, but and many articles in Tradition Journal, which is the journal of the RCA. He also wrote wrote articles in Judaism, which was known at that time through the conservative movement. But many Orthodox rabbis did write, you know, for that prominent journal at the time. Many of his books. So the first book that I was introduced to was Faith After the Holocaust, which dealt with, was really one of the first rabbis that dealt with theodicy and evil after the Holocaust, and how to come to grips with belief and faith in God afterwards. And he talks about evil and faith and afterwards also how the state of Israel came into being. So over the last 10 years, I've really engrossed myself. After that, that was a long time ago when I started looking at the Faith After the Holocaust. But then I came back to his writings, I would say about 10 years ago. And I started really analyzing his writings and getting into the idea of divine self-limitation. That's one of his main ideas throughout his writings, that I feel that all of his writings, somehow in the backdrop, he has this idea of divine self-limitation. And this book on Megillat Esther, I mean, basically, it's a book, it's a Megillah that does not have God's name in it. God's name is missing. So I just feel that the Megillat Esther book in general is a great analysis and highlights really Rabbi Berkowitz's real philosophy on his idea of divine self-limitation. The first book that I wrote, I wrote an article a few years ago before on Tzimtzum in the writings of Eliezer Berkowitz, which means Tzimtzum is another word for divine self-limitation. It's a word that was basically, I don't know, created or by Rabbi Isaac Luria, who is a Kabbalist, and Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz somehow borrows this term, and in the core of his writings, he doesn't necessarily use the word Tzimtzum, but he uses the terms divine self-abnegation, divine self-control, hiding God, Hester Panim. I just feel that this book, Megillat Esther, really could portray some of the philosophy and the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. For that, the first book that I did write was on faith and freedom, which is a Haggadah on the Passover Haggadah. I'll just explain a little bit, you know, what I did. Basically, you asked about the Megillat Esther, but they're basically in the same format. Basically, what I've done was I said that Eliezer Berkowitz wrote 19 books. He did not write a commentary on the Haggadah, and he did not write a commentary on Megillat Esther. So what I've done is I've gone through almost all the books, almost 19 of them, and it was a hard process. And I've taken excerpts from the books, and I created a commentary to the Megillat Esther and also to the Haggadah for Pesach. And both of those books are out and published through Urim.
And thinking about the book and the way that it's structured, so as we were saying before, it includes, of course, the actual Megillah, so the text of the Book of Esther, but it also includes the Ma'ariv service in which the Megillah is read in the nighttime. And so was that your decision? Did you think it was important to include this in it to be a real liturgical text? Or is that something that the publishers thought would be a good idea?
So I did think that it was my idea to bring it in. If you can bring this book with you to the nighttime service and use it as a siddur and also for Megillat Esther. So you don't have to take two books at the same time. One to use for davening, and then also then get, you know, Megillah, you know, from the bookshelf also. So this way you can have both. The Megillat Esther, is after the prayer service. So the prayer service, you know, talking about how the excerpts were introduced and how it made a commentary for it. The prayer service was actually a little bit easier to make the commentary, because Rabbi Berkowitz did write a book called Prayer that was published in 1962 by Yeshiva University Press. And it's a pamphlet, really a pamphlet, it's about 100 pages. And so there was really a flow to the commentary for Maariv service, because if I wanted to, you know, talk about a certain word, you know, he did talk about that. So I was able to take the excerpt and attach it and hook it to the words of the text for the davening part of it, for the Maariv part. But for the Megillat Esther part, it was definitely a harder task, because there aren't that many times through the course of his writings that he mentions Megillat Esther at all. And a lot of the excerpts are really thematic connections, you know, on certain words or certain hooks that I would say, okay, this is a great excerpt. You know, I read the books many times. What I did was I put stickies in the books and I'm like, oh, that would be a great commentary for this word, or that would be a great commentary for this pasuk. So the Megillat Esther was a little bit a harder task and a rewarding task to come up with a commentary for the whole book.
Was there any cases where it was the opposite challenge? So it seems like in some cases or many cases, it was hard to figure out what would be the best form of commentary to include for a given verse. Were there any cases where the verse just had so many things that you thought that you could bring from Rabbi Berkowitz, or were there not really many of those cases where you had to choose between so many different forms of commentary?
So there could be repetition. So you know, if we read Rabbi Berkowitz's writings, he'll talk about faith all the time. Some of just the titles of his books, Faith After the Holocaust, With God in Hell, which is a book that he wrote after Faith After the Holocaust, to show how during the war they had faith even throughout the Holocaust. That's why it's called With God in Hell. So faith comes up all the time, that word. So yes, I could have attached probably many excerpts on, you know, from that word faith, emunah. Even in the davening part of it, where we have the emunah kol zot, you know, I picked one, the emunah kol zot, where right after Shema, and faithful is, you know, is all of this. You know, I used one excerpt from Faith After the Holocaust, but there are probably, you know, I would say 100 excerpts on emunah that I could have used throughout and tried to attach it to different places where there's the word emunah, you know, something like that. I'll give one example of a case where I was just like really happy to find an excerpt, you know, or a commentary in the Megillah where it talks about Haman, and it talks about bowing down mishtachavim and bowing down to evil. I'll find the source. One second. I'll come back to it. But basically, there's a place where and Haman saw that Mordechai did not bow down and did not prostrate himself before him. Then Haman was full of wrath. Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai koreo mishtachavev yamaleham cheman hama. There's another place also that has to do with bowing. Right before it, v'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachavim la-haman. Right? So it has to do with bowing. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed down and prostrated themselves before Haman. And what there, I wanted to show that there was, that this is a case of evil, that they bowed down to him. There was a case where he talks about where he was in the library, actually, in Berlin during the time of the Holocaust, during the time, and he talks about this Nazi guard going through the library and how scared he was. And at the end, he says, year after year, It was the same story that repeated itself before our eyes, knees bowing to the success and worshiping it. So I just, it's a figurative way of explaining Korim u'mishtachavim, that bowing down to Haman, that here it's the knees bowing down to the success and worshiping it. So sometimes, you know, there was a play on the words that I was like, wow, this is, you know, a cool interpretation and a cool explanation that could be put as a commentary to the text. But it took a lot of time to figure out which texts did go to each word and each hook. It was fun, and at the same time, I really got to delve into his writings and really got to know his writings a lot more because of that.
We were just saying that faith is something that he speaks about a lot. It comes up in his titles. It comes up in his work. And as you said as well, two of your works on Rabbi Berkowitz have faith in their title. Maybe we can focus now on the title of this book, Faith Fulfilled. Why that title? Was that the first title you chose? Was that coming? Did it that only come after a lot of deliberation? Why did you choose this title, and what does it mean?
So the first title, like you said, is Faith and Freedom, and this title is Faith Fulfilled. I did want to use, I think, the word faith in the title, because that's really, I think, one of his main ideas throughout all of his writings. His definition of faith is very interesting. He basically says that in the first book, I have an excerpt in Faith and Freedom where they believed in Az Yashir, where it says Ve'aminu b'Hashem u'Moshe Avdo, where they believed in God and in Moshe, their servant. And in a few places, this is I used from this place from the book With God in Hell. He basically says that the word Vayaminu, which means to trust or believe, is really a trust in God, that God is going to act and He's going to be there for us. Also, he talks about this in his book Man and God: Studies in Biblical Theology, which is a massive book, where he talks about different concepts. He talks about knowledge of God, the Spirit of God, the name of God, the concept of holiness, the biblical meaning of justice. These are just the chapters of the book. And he talks about there a whole chapter on the faith of God. And he says that basically emunah is to be trustworthy, to be ne'eman. It comes from the adjective ne'eman, to be trustworthy. So I think that even though that God's name is not found in the Megillah, I think that there is still an emunah in God, an emunah that Mordechai and Esther had. I can delve now into a little bit of the divine self-limitation, because I think that will play into this answer. In the intro to the book, I write that there's this pasuk in the Megillah, chapter 4:14, and who knows whether you have come to the royal estate for such a time as this. And what I do is I include an excerpt from God, Man, in History to elucidate, to explain this pasuk that basically says that Mordechai is telling Esther that you're basically at this time and at this moment for a particular reason. And he believes that's the emunah in God. Even though God's name is not used, it's he's saying there's an opportune time here. And what I do is I bring a quote from God, Man, in History, page 156, to say that the rabbis of the Talmud were right to view man as a partner of God in the works of creation. And that's from the Gemara on Shabbat. Who would say where the work of God comes to an end and the human contribution begins? Man may be as nothing before God, yet God nonetheless desires man's partnership. And I think that we can spend a whole hour, 2 hours on the concept of divine self-limitation. I did write an essay that's included in this book on divine self-limitation, on Tzimtzum. But I think the other part of it is that we're partners with God. And I think that's one of the reasons that I put here is that I try to analyze is that is that God's name is not found in the Megillahs because I think he wants us to come to show our presence, to act and to create in the world and to be part of the world, and to be part of what's going on. And Esther and Mordechai, I think, did that. And they were the main players in this. So Faith Fulfilled, I think is an apropos title to show that that Mordechai and Esther, plus all the Yehudim at the time, did have faith in God. It was a faith fulfilled. At the end of the Megillah, there's actually a statement that says they were kiyamu v'kiblu the Torah again. That with all of this, they reenacted almost the Gemara says that they reenacted Ma'amar Har Sinai in a way that they reaccepted the Torah. Which is an unbelievable statement that at the time of Purim they accepted the Torah again. So Faith Fulfilled, I think, is something that I think it's a powerful, I hope a powerful title that we should have faith, emunah, in God, that God is there and trustworthy, even though necessarily he may not be so, when we say the word present or we feel him all the time. We could talk a little bit about, the guiding that's there, but I think that's why I named it Faith Fulfilled.
Going back to what we said towards the beginning, that Rabbi Berkowitz wrote a lot, so 19 books, many essays. And if we think about the different topics, he's writing about philosophy, he's writing about theology, he's writing about halakha, about Jewish law. How do his ideas in these areas intersect in his commentary or in the commentary that he put together on Megillat Esther?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that they intersect because throughout all his writings, they really intersect, because that's how he wrote. Again, he had this broad knowledge of secular knowledge, philosophy, theology. He was a rabbi that was very devoted to halakha. And again, to repeat a little bit, but I really do feel that the backdrop of this divine self-limitation, his idea of divine self-limitation has consequences to us in that we're God's partners in creation, the same way that we talked about the title of Faith Fulfilled. Through the book, there are many examples that I try to bring of this intersection. On page 86, where we talk about the word Ra, I bring an excerpt to explain how Rabbi Berkowitz explains the concept of evil and how evil could exist. When we're dealing with the words Venahafochu, which is that everything turns upside down, everything was turned opposite, I bring excerpts to discuss God's unconvincing presence in history, and to discuss miracles, and how could they exist? Because those are major topics that Rabbi Berkowitz explained. And then his intersection with halakha, on page 102, there's a quote where it says Vayechtov Mordechai, that Mordechai wrote down everything. I thought that was a great time, an apropos time to bring an excerpt on how Rabbi Berkowitz really believed that the oral law really shouldn't have been written down. That today the oral law is really something that should have been oral and not written, and he believes it's too stagnant. He actually says that many people criticized, but he called it Karaite Judaism in some of his articles, which is something that some people didn't want to, agree with. But he really believed that halakha in general, he defines it from the shoresh, from the root of the word halach. Halach means to walk, to go on its way. And he believes that halakha is the application of the Torah to life. So we're in a specific time in history and a specific situation. So the halakha has to be applied to those specific times and those specific situations. And he calls this process halachic Judaism because It's halakha. Halakha is a way of going. It's a way of life. And a lot of times he criticizes, the rabbis through the time of modern Judaism, of the time of that we're here. He says like he one of his major obstacles was he tried to solve the aguna crisis. The aguna is a chain, the woman, where a man doesn't give a get to the husband. And he has many quotes where he basically says, and he writes this in his book, Not in Heaven, the practice of our time in the application of the marriage and divorce laws of the Torah often leads to grievous human suffering and causes a great deal of chilul Hashem. It is ethically indefensible, but halakha is not responsible for it. Which means, in a way, it's a passive-aggressive way of almost saying that he believes halakha is there to help us and to solve problems, and to and that's his intersection, I think, of all these philosophies. He, throughout all his books, he was a very open person and courageous, and ahead of his times in a lot of his works that he wrote. Just another snippet that I found. There's a new book that was just published by Urim that was republished, Jewish Women in Time and Torah. And it was just republished with a foreword by Rachel Berkowitz, by Rabbi Berkowitz's granddaughter. In it, and before I've read a lot of what she's written, she actually went through some of his, I guess his archives and some of the things that he had and correspondences that he had. One of the main teachers, which I might have mentioned before, I don't know if I did, but one of his main teachers or his main teacher in his life, I know I'm going a little bit all over the place, but it's important for people to know where he came from. So again, he was in Berlin, he was in the Hildesheimer Academy, and his main teacher was the Sri Deish, Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg, who was really one of the greatest rabbis of our time in Germany at that time. And he wrote this responsa called the Sri Deish. Actually, Rabbi Berkowitz was the one who saved these responsa. When he left Germany, he took the responsa with him. And when he was in England, every time that there was a bomb going off, he took the responsa with him down to the shelter so that the responsa wouldn't get lost. But going back to the Sri Deish, he had a correspondence with the Sri Deish's teacher, and this is an amazing sentence. I'll read it, and I think this also has to do with the halakha part, but it has to do with how bold he was. This is a private correspondence, and he writes, "Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema." And he's talking about the Aguna crisis. He says, and I'm going to translate. He says, "I believe with complete faith that there is a solution to the Aguna crisis. Mipnei ani ma'amin, because I believe." It's almost like a 14th ani ma'amin, a principle of the Rambam. And he says, "Mipnei ani ma'amin bekel belokei Israel, because I believe in the God of Israel, uvetorato, and in his Torah." I believe in the eternal strength of the halakha, liftor et habayo, to solve the problems havrot et chaye am Yisrael, to solve the problems that are passing the lives of the nation of Israel. That's an amazing statement, and I love it, because the message of halakha, it's supposed to be there to help us and not to harm us. There are many other instances where he believes that the halakha is supposed to be for the ways of pleasantness and the paths of peace. I'm delving a little bit more on the side of halakha here, but I do believe that there's an intersection in all of his writings between theology, philosophy, halakha. If we believe in the divine self-limitation, I do believe that the divine self-limitation also plays into his role into how a rabbi or a dayan should judge and be partners with God in creation, because God somehow withdrew to give us the power to create and give us the power to make life and halakha better for the people.
Looking a little bit more at the topic of halakha, you include in the book an essay from Rabbi Berkowitz about women reading the Megillah. First question on that, why did you decide to include this essay? And then the second part is, what can we learn? What's a key takeaway from this essay?
So the essay was brought. It's a chapter in his book that we talked about of Jewish women in time and Torah. It's pretty much a straight excerpt from the book. I just put it as a chapter. He goes back to the sources, the main sources, showing that Rashi, Rambam, I think the Ran, all say that women can read the Megillah, and publicly even for men. And he delves into the other sources later on that disagree with that. And he believes that we should really go back to the original sources. He believes also he makes a comparison to Kiddush on Friday night, showing that really women have the same obligation as men do. And one of his outcomes that he leaves it as is really as a sign of respect. Men and women should really alternate every Friday night, and a man, the husband, one week should do it, and the woman the next week should do it. Of course, this is not something that that many have taken upon themselves to the minhag to accept. But he wasn't afraid to voice his opinion and to say what he thought. He wrote in his book, in many books, in his book, In Crisis and Faith, he started talking about women in his book, Not in Heaven, which is a translation of the Hebrew of, which was called Halakha Tafkida, what's the purpose of Halakha. So Not in Heaven is really an abridged version of that. He talks about women's role in that, but really in Jewish women in time and Torah, he starts talking about women's role in society and how today women, he goes through the difference between Torah taught and Torah tolerated. I think that's one of the main differences, is that there are certain ideals and certain societal norms that the women had in the time of the Torah. And he goes through that without, really going through it in depth. He basically says that in the time of the Torah, women were not the main characters, the main people, and as time has gone on in society today, he sees absolutely no reason that women today are heads of CEOs, and there should be no reason that they should not have the same capabilities as men within. He talks about that when it comes to in Mizumin, many other examples as well. So I think that that he talks about going back to the Aguna problem also. That's one of the main. He sees no reason that a woman should not that the problem should not be solved. And again, he doesn't see that the problem was really stemming from, as he calls it, halakha. He says outright that unfortunately it's the rabbis and their objections to solving the problem that's the cause of not solving the aguna problem. I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. I appreciate that. Going back to the book as a whole, in your opinion, what is the main message or lesson that readers can take away from the commentary?
So I think that the Rabbi Berkowitz's message is, I'm trying to convey through both books, that his writings are so relevant and apropos to our time, that he really wrote this, 50, 60, 40, 30 years ago. It was just his 30th Yahrzeit, and there was a convention, to honor his 30th Yahrzeit, which I'm very honored that I was one of the speakers at the convention, and I talked about the concept of Tzimtzum, which I'm talking about now, of divine withdrawal. But I think all of those lessons and all of these ideas, he talks about anti-Semitism. I mean, that's one of the ideas that we didn't talk about that is also found in Megillat Esther with Haman and Amalek. It's so apparent that today in our time, it's one of the biggest problems that we face today. That that just because we're different, that's what it says. We're different. They, you know, the Amalek hated us. Haman hated us, and history repeats itself. The Holocaust is a prime example of exactly anti-Semitism to its core. So there's so many topics that I think that I wanted to bring to the forefront in a more, I guess, in a format that one would be able to find his writings. Many, I don't know, would go to his books, his 19 books. But I think if what I try to do is bring it through a life cycle event like Pesach and Purim, hopefully, people would be able to find it, and it would be a little bit more appealing to people to say, oh, this is something that Rabbi Berkowitz talks about. That's amazing. Maybe I'm going to go read his book, Not in Heaven. Maybe I'm going to go read his book, Faith After the Holocaust. That's really, what my goal was with all of this when I started. First, to just be more engrossed in this unbelievable rabbi and his writings, and how much I admire his writings. That's hopefully coming forward. But the last 10 years I really spent learning him, hopefully, he was underappreciated. I think also, I don't know how many, he didn't have the same. He was in Chicago and then he moved to Israel. He wasn't a yeshiva university rabbi. I think that if he taught in YU, I think he would be much more well known. There were other rabbis at YU that were much more well known. One can compare him to Rabbi Soloveitchik, who probably the most comparable in many, many ways. But I think that Rabbi Berkowitz went a little bit more, he pushed the envelope a little bit more than possibly the latter. So I think that in general, I just wanted to show what a comprehensive philosophy he had, through his excerpts in a more palatable way. And hopefully, that was achieved through these books.
Definitely. I'd say it was definitely achieved. We really appreciate all the work that you've done on this, and hopefully more to come in the future. So with that, I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to ask you the traditional closing New Books Network question. What are you working on next?
So the next book that's actually coming out is another book on Rabbi Berkowitz. I hope that it will be out within the next year, also through Urim Press. We're in the beginning stages now, but the book, thank God, is finished. It's in the same format as the others, and it's on Megillat Rut and the Torah reading for Shavuot. So hopefully it will be the third part to the set, first on Purim, and then Pesach, and then Shavuot. It's hopefully I guess tell that the title is Faith and Fortitude. So it has another faith in there. It's another time we could talk about the fortitude part. Emunah is really something that he talks about all the time. But I really hope that the book will be out hopefully within the next year or two. I don't think that it will be out by this Shavuot, but I hope by next Shavuot it will be out, and people will hopefully enjoy it. And I think that I don't know if you have any other questions, any more questions, or you have any other questions, or
nothing else that I've got.
I just wanted to say that just in general, how rewarding this experience has been. I became close with Rabbi Berkowitz's sons. Rabbi Dov Berkowitz is a rabbi in Israel, and another son, Abraham, Professor Avraham Berkowitz. And I really appreciate all their help. They're wonderful people. I really thanks to Tzvi Maurer at Urim Press, who was also a great help in all of this. And I just feel very grateful that I was able to put out these two books, and hopefully another one will come out, and that the positive feedback that the books have gotten, and the most rewarding thing is also that how many people have come to me and said that I've introduced them to Rabbi Berkowitz, to his thoughts, and many didn't know who he was. And, you know, I'm grateful for that, to expose this, this amazing, amazing rabbi.
That's great. I'm really looking forward to the next one. And this has been great. The book's great. And I really appreciate all the insight that you provided in the book and in this conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your questions. They were very insightful, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah. We have been talking to Dr. Reuven Mohl, author of Faith Fulfilled, Megillat Esther and the Ma'ariv Evening Service Reporter, with commentary from the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, published by Urim in 2022. Happy reading, my friends.